from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many American cities want more people to ride bikes. For cleaner air, for less traffic, for healthier residents, more communities are creating bike lanes or special paths and putting up signs saying, share the road. But the philosophy of how that road should be shared has undergone a huge shift in the last few years, as NHPR's Outside In team discovered in a recent episode. Today in The Exchange, we jump onto what they learned, and a little bit later, another story to chew on. If you enjoy some lobster this summer, European fears that American lobsters are becoming an invasive species. We'll cover that in our second half. Right now, let's hear from you on bikes and cars. How well do they coexist in your community? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter @NHPRExchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Well, helping us out for the hour, Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In. That's our show about the natural world and how we use it. And by the way, if you want to check out the episodes we're talking about, go to nhpr.org. or subscribe to the Outside In podcast. And Sam, thank you very much for helping us. We really appreciate it.
Always love to be here.
So let's start with a little journalistic full disclosure. Your own biking habits, Sam, and your own biking history.
Yeah, so I got into cycling, I think as many people do, with my parents. And they would take us out for long rides. And then, got my cycling merit badge as a Boy Scout.
Good
job.
Which,
of course, includes a 50. We rode around Lake Winnipesaukee. That was our 50-mile ride to complete the merit badge. But, I've been racing for years, both road and mountain bike, and I was a bike mechanic as well. And most recently have been sort of, because I was a bike mechanic, got hit up to help out the local sort of cycling advocacy group, the Central New Hampshire Bicycling Coalition, where I've helped them to put together a film festival and to fix up bikes over at the Bike Swap.
So an avid bike commuter also, we should say.
Yeah, so I ride my bike to work almost every day throughout the winter until I sort of picked up a ski coaching gig in the winter. I was riding even on snowy days. So I'm the most extreme of the cycling community. I'm a total devotee. And do things that other people think are crazy.
Okay, so perfect segue. Speaking of extreme, you've got some competition for that title, Sam. The main subject of one of your recent episodes about sharing the road, cars and bikes, is a guy named John Forrester. So who is he and why is he so important?
John Forrester was, he's born in London. He's the son of C.S. Forrester, who is an author who wrote Horatio Hornblower and The African Queen.
Which is pretty cool. That's the Humphrey Bogart movie, right?
Exactly. But he moved to the U.S., to California, and became an engineer where he designed shrink tubing for the aeronautics industry. But he was also a devout amateur cyclist. He raced, he toured, he got himself very expensive, fancy European bicycles for all this, and became one of the nation's most vocal cycling advocates all throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
But more than an advocate for, hey, everybody should get out there and bike. It's good for your body. It's good for your community. He really promoted a particular worldview. What was that, Sam?
It's called vehicular cycling. And so this is the idea that actually much of our cycling law is founded on, which is that bicycles are considered vehicles in traffic. They should obey the rules of the road, and they should act just like a car, in contrast with how we treat pedestrians, who have their own separate infrastructure. They're pulled out of the flow of traffic, and they have different rules that apply to them. Cyclists, we consider to be like cars in the U.S. And he wrote a manual called Effective Cycling, in which he sort of laid out, here's how you ride your bicycle like a vehicle. It was sort of the go-to book on cycling safety for many years. And as part of his advocacy, he also became famous for fighting against separate bike lanes, because in his mind, the proper way to ride a bicycle was to just act like a car, and so for years he fought bike lanes and became well known for that.
Well, and we definitely want to talk more about that, but let's play a little bit. You interviewed John Forrester, and here's sort of his description about what vehicular cycling means. Let's hear.
I am not going to be terrified by militant motorists who insist on motoring supremacy. I am against cyclist inferiority. I am equally against the other side of that coin, motorist supremacy. We should all be equal drivers.
Cyclist inferiority. What does that mean?
Well, so John drew this distinction between folks who cycle the way he cycles, which is, you know, sort of enthusiastic, out in the road, claiming your space in traffic, versus what he called gutter hugging, cringing along the side of the road, cyclist inferiority.
Hang on, that's
cyclist.
What I did this morning on my way in.
Right, and in his mind, the push to have more bike lanes is something that was spearheaded by cyclists who were this sort of quote unquote gutter hugging variety, who were afraid of traffic, and therefore wanted their own separate facilities, and that's why he believed that the push for bike lanes was something that cars actually would find was mostly for the convenience of drivers.
Works for them.
Get cyclists out of the way, and therefore speed up traffic and sort of shunt these cyclists off onto this inferior infrastructure, as he called it, these separate bike lanes. And this battle began when he was in Palo Alto in the 70s. There was an ordinance passed that required if there was a side path, so a sidewalk or something else, you were on a bicycle, you were required to ride on that through this ordinance. And he was given a ticket by a police officer, which he fought through the courts. And it was his response to being told that he had to ride his bicycle on the sidewalk that led to this years of activism against bike lanes.
Well, and now it seems like riding on the sidewalk, you're not supposed to do that, right? That's a big no-no.
In fact, that is one of John Forrester's legacies, is he successfully argued that riding on the sidewalk is less safe for cyclists and for drivers, and that cycling on the sidewalk should be outlawed. And it is still outlawed today in Concord, New Hampshire, thanks to the efforts of folks like John Forrester.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from Mr. Forrester. Here's how he describes what he calls motordom. This is, you know, cars and those who advocate for them. He really feels like motordom has brainwashed many cyclists in advocating for a separate infrastructure. So let's hear Sam.
Motordom doesn't have to say anything anymore, because the bicycle activists, environmentalists, and whomever you like, anti-motoring people, they want side paths, because that's what the ignorant people want. And when I say ignorant, I mean it. The people who don't understand.
Again, that's John Forrester. He is in a recent Outside In episode with Sam Evans Brown, which takes a deep look at sharing the road between cars and bikes and competing philosophies around how this should be done. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, especially cyclists. Let's hear from you. How do you feel about this idea that you should view yourself as a car, acting like a car, or whether you should stay in a special bike lane on the side of the road, gutter hugging, if you want to put it that way? Again, join us. What do you think? 1-800-892-6477. How do you behave when you're out cycling? Also, if you're a driver, how do you see cyclists behaving? 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Sam, there we have John Forrester saying, ignorant people who don't understand, meaning the people who don't think like I do. Who are these ignorant people?
Well, it's the vast majority of
people. A lot of people,
right? Ride bikes, yeah. So there's this sort of hierarchy is probably the wrong word, but it's like
schism.
Yeah, well, there's classification of people who ride bikes or are interested in riding bikes, and it's basically less than 1% of people in the world fit into this category as strong and fearless. So they will ride on any road. They will ride in any conditions. These are the me's of the world, the people who love biking and will do it no matter what. Less than 10%, so maybe 7-8% of people are in this sort of enthused and confident category. So they are people who like riding, are willing to get out riding. They probably don't feel safe on every road, but they feel safe on a lot of roads. And then there's this massive meaty middle. 60% of people will say that they're interested in riding bikes, but are concerned about the safety of it. And so the people that John is referring to as the sort of cringing gutter huggers, the ignorant people, are the vast majority of the populace. Including, you know, another one third of folks who say that they'll never ride a bike, no way, no how, because, you know, for whatever reason.
So a lot of people. When he puts down a lot of people as ignorant,
right?
That's a lot of people.
And this gets to the ways in which, well, so John Forrester was problematic in a number of ways. One we just heard, which is his style. He viewed his activities as part of a war. He is a warrior on behalf of his rights as a cyclist to ride his bike in the road. And as a warrior, he sort of no holds were barred. He used incredibly inflammatory rhetoric and was you know, very offensive and often off-putting. So he alienated a lot of people along the way, but he was also incredibly forceful and was successful in getting his point of view codified in the places where it mattered. And so in the episode, we dig into what are called the AASHTO guidelines. AASHTO is the American Association of Highway and Transportation Organizations. So it's like your state DOT, all the engineers who design our roads, they get together at the national level and they write these guidelines of what is a safe road.
For everyone.
And they came out with their first manual for designing bike facilities in 1974, and it recommended separated, protected bike lanes. And in response to those recommendations, John began submitting copious amounts of comments so that when they were rewritten in 1981, they had flipped, and they now said separate bike paths are now unsafe. And so when they were rewritten in 1981, and you know, actually the gentleman who rewrote these rules lives here in New Hampshire, and I talked to him about what happened. He said basically the only one submitting comments was John Forrester. And for decades, the recommendations that your state highway engineers were essentially were getting on bike paths were essentially written by John Forrester.
That's why this story is so important. It isn't just that he's this sort of grumpy person who thinks my way or the highway.
Exactly.
But it's so interesting to hear you say that, Sam. I just want to repeat it. So in 1974, you know, this federal and state policymakers were sitting down saying, how can we make these roads safe for everybody? They had separate bike lanes, but then because of this guy and his acolytes, followers, fellow believers, they got changed, and cyclists like me, who are gutter huggers, really got no consideration. That's why this matters.
That's why this matters. And I after the episode came out, people sent me emails in response to it, and
there was a
city planner who wrote to me and you know, he actually used a swear, which I won't use, but he said, I can't tell you how much time I've spent arguing with traffic engineers about bleeping AASHTO guidelines. That these guidelines, they don't have the force of law, but if you're a professional engineer, if you ignore the guidelines, you open yourself up to liability, because if someone gets hurt on the infrastructure you've designed, they can say, hey, look, this wasn't following the AASHTO guidelines, and they could sue you. And so engineers who are cautious types to begin with were often unwilling to go beyond what the guidelines said.
Let's take some calls, Sam, and then we have a lot more to talk about how John Forrester influenced guidelines for so long, when and how that started to change to see some of the bike lanes and so forth that we see today. But I want to bring our listeners into it. So again, you can join us. We'd love to hear from you this morning, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Michelle's calling from Somersworth. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air. Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Michelle.
Good. I was just going to say, I have friends that are like major bike enthusiasts. I'm not a rider myself, but I think the bike lanes would make things a little safer. And I also think that bicyclists do need to choose whether they want to be, you know, obey the rules of the road or not. Because I just experienced this yesterday. It's funny you should be talking about it. I was driving down through a busy part of downtown Dover, and a bicyclist is like kind of riding right alongside me and then whipped right through a red stoplight.
So
and I was like, you're going to get hurt.
So know? Following the rules of the road when it's convenient and when it's not convenient,
and,
oh well.
Right, exactly. Like I can just go in through, I've seen them go in through cars down Central Ave. It's just crazy. I just really fear for them. You know?
Well, Michelle, I'm glad you called. And this is the conundrum, isn't it, Sam?
Well, and absolutely. I mean, I think when you look at the countries where cycling has become mainstream, it's not just that they have, you know, so the country that everyone points to is the Netherlands, right? But where, you know, somewhere between 30 and in some cities, even as much as 50% of the traffic is people on bicycles. They have infrastructure for those bikes that you know, anyone would feel safe on. Grandmothers, small children, anyone will feel safe riding on this infrastructure. But also, they have cycling education in their schools. And you get, you know, a certificate when you're a small child, you've graduated from the cycling safety program. You get a certificate that basically says you're now qualified to ride on your own. You know the rules of the road and you will follow them.
So like a driver's license for cyclists.
Exactly. You get it when you're like 10, though. So not quite so stringent. So certainly following the rules of the road is an important piece of education for cyclists that we have not locked down here in New Hampshire. But I will say that drivers have this tendency to spotlight rule breaking that cyclists do, but be willing to ignore rule breaking that drivers do. And there have been studies that have shown that drivers actually break traffic laws just as much as cyclists do. They break different ones, particularly if you were to call out every driver who broke the speed limit, for instance, it'd be a very different conversation.
Or for scrolling through their phones while they drive.
Texting
while
driving.
Speaking as a cyclist, I see this all the time.
Exactly.
So go ahead.
And so you know, cyclists tend to the two areas where they tend to break the rules are at intersections, and this is largely, cyclists would argue, this is largely because these intersections are not designed with them in mind, and you know, I'm actually not terribly sympathetic to this argument, but the idea is that, hey, I can actually be more safe if I get a jump ahead of the cars rather than trying to start up alongside all of them.
But it's terrifying for
exactly.
drivers like Michelle, who doesn't want to hurt anybody, clearly.
It is. And also, I think more to the point, the problem with this idea is that it's a public relations loser. You know, if you're a cyclist and you say, oh, you know, I don't need to follow the rules because I'm just trying to keep myself safe, most people are going to see you and just think that guy's a jerk, and they're going to be annoyed at cyclists in general.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for the call. Here's a Facebook comment from Martha that also gets to what you just mentioned, Sam. Martha says, my kids just started riding to school recently, and I am torn between making them ride in the dirt shoulder, well away from traffic, versus, quote, taking the lane and forcing cars to slow down and go around us. I'm always amazed at how close cars think it is okay to come to cyclists. Martha, thank you so much for the Facebook comment. And this is tough, Sam. You want your kids to be safe, but you also want to teach them the rules of the road.
Exactly. And I think this sort of spotlights another issue, which is that driver education doesn't have a very strong component about talking about how to deal with cyclists in the road. And there aren't many cyclists in the road, so many drivers aren't sure of how they're supposed to deal with them. This gets to an effect called the safety in numbers effect. That basically, the more bikes there are on the road, the safer it is for all the other bikes because drivers have been habituated to having to pass them.
And if you're in the Netherlands or you're in France, you're more used to it. But here, I would say both sides are kind of clueless.
Exactly.
If I could put it that way. Well, lots more calls after a short break. Michelle, thank you for that one. Martha, thanks for the Facebook comment. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or again, call 1-800-892-6477.
It's Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, sharing the road between cars and bikes as more communities in New Hampshire try to encourage cycling. NHPR's outside-in team looked at the debate over how that road should be shared. Turns out, there's been a huge shift in recent years. What do you think? How well is the road shared in your community? What's your own philosophy about sharing the road as a driver or a cyclist? Send email to exchange at nhpr.org, respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And we'll want to let everybody know a little bit later in our show, we are going to turn to another summertime theme that Outside In brought us, lobster, and whether American lobsters are considered an invasive species in Northern Europe. Really interesting, and we'll hear about that a little bit later. Right now, though, sharing the road between cars and bikes. And Sam, here's an email that came in from Angie. She says, up in central New Hampshire, many roads have little to no shoulder, so I have no choice but to ride in the road. Some of the roads are so damaged along the edges. I do ride right in the middle of the lane. I've had very few issues with cars doing this. However, Angie says, when I tow a trailer with my daughter and we take up more space, I've been honked at and yelled at for taking up so much space. Angie, thank you for the email. And by the way, really honking and yelling at somebody
with a kid,
like, let's just show an example of, you know, how to behave. But anyway, go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say that, you know, this to me gets at a couple of really interesting points. The first is that this idea that we can all share the same infrastructure, even though there are different types of vehicles traveling at vastly different rates of speed, does work. Sometimes it works when we're talking about roads that don't have a ton of traffic generally. It also works when we're talking about roads that have very little bicycle traffic. I mean, if you were in a car and you have to pass, you know, one cyclist every week, that's not a big deal. If you're in a car and there are 10 cyclists every time you go, you know, take a 3-mile drive to work, it becomes a different story. The sharing the infrastructure is sort of premised on the idea that there are not going to be many bicycles on the road generally. But that said, the other point this gets at to me is the way that this reporting the story has changed how I would give recommendations to my own kids, because I grew up learning how to ride as a vehicular cyclist, learning how to ride in the road.
Like John Forrester says you should.
John Forrester actually contributed to the Boy Scout Cycling Merit Badge Manual that was sort of the touchstone for my early cycling
experiences. So showing his deep influence in cycling culture, rules, regs, and so forth.
Absolutely. And then one of the talking points you always hear is that riding on the sidewalk is, in fact, more dangerous than riding in the road. And reporting the story, you find out that there's very, very little evidence for that assertion, which has become the foundation for many laws. It's illegal to ride your bike on the sidewalk because the idea is that it's more dangerous for everyone. The studies that supposedly come to this conclusion have been reanalyzed by a number of researchers, and they found that, in fact, it's probably not the case that it's more dangerous to ride your bike on the sidewalk, and that it sort of road by road depends. There are many busy, busy roads with lots of cars on them in which you might actually be safer, especially if you're a small child, riding your bike on the sidewalk versus trying to ride out in traffic.
Sure, on Main Street downtown, you're not going to ride on the sidewalk. But elsewhere, if there's not a lot of people on the sidewalk, why not? Especially when people are, again, scrolling through Facebook while they're driving. Do you really want to be sharing the road with those people?
And the classic example of this here in Concord is Loudon Road going up to the Heights. There's two sidewalks on either side. There's two lanes of traffic where the cars drive very, very quickly. And the lanes have been striped with sharrows. So if you're supposed to ride your bike up there, you were supposed to ride in the middle of one of those very fast lanes.
No way.
And all the time, all the time, I will be up there and I will see people who are coming from the Heights down to Main Street, and they ride on the sidewalk because they instinctually know that it is safer for them to ride that sidewalk where there are very few pedestrians rather than try to take that lane.
So ride on the sidewalk if you're in a crazy part of town.
And, you know, and but and again, this gets to the sort of fundamental injustice of it. We had a producer who, after the story came out, told me that he rides his bike to go get groceries on Loudoun Road, and he has not felt safe on that road. So he rides on the sidewalk, and he was stopped by a police officer and told to ride in traffic because it's against the law to ride on the sidewalk. And so the way the laws are written now fundamentally put cyclists into unsafe situations because the safest decision has been outlawed because of, frankly, bad science.
Well, and this gets to an email that Doug sent us from Mason. He says, it doesn't really matter who is at fault in a bike-car, quote, interaction. The biker is the one who will get hurt. Doug says, I've had some discussions with motorists, but self-preservation would seem to take precedence. So that seems to be what you're saying, Sam. I mean, you want to keep body and soul together.
Yeah. And so this is what I mean when I say this has changed how I would teach my kids how to ride a bike. I no longer am going to tell a small child to take the lane. I would tell kids to ride on the sidewalk if you think that's safer.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Skip in Wilmington, Vermont. Hi, Skip. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for listening to me. I've, as someone who respects bicyclists on the side of the road, one of the things that's always perplexed me about the side of the road that bikes are supposed to ride on, following the same direction of traffic, one of the problems that I see is that very often an oncoming car can see the bicyclist, but the bicyclist is oblivious to the car that's approaching it. My crazy thought has always been, why don't we ride bikes on the opposite side of the road so the bicyclists can see oncoming traffic the same way cars can see each other?
Oh, like facing traffic.
But I know that it sounds like a head-on collision, but cars go faster than bikes anyway.
No, I hear what you're saying, Skip. Yeah.
If a bicyclist can see an oncoming car, they'll be able to adjust their driving.
Yeah, you can sort of dash out of the way.
Because sometimes, especially if it's a lonely road, you don't even hear a car coming from behind. And, you know, I occasionally bike, and I like driving on the side of the road where I can see the oncoming traffic so I don't get whacked from behind.
Okay. Well, Skip, thank you for calling in. What do you think, Sam?
I personally, I didn't deeply research the answer to this question before, so this is sort of my gut instinct, but I personally think that's a terrible idea, largely because, you know, cyclists, you know, they travel at various rates of speeds, of course, but generally they're moving much faster than a walker, right? I mean, you can be going anywhere from 12 to 25 miles an hour on a bike going down a hill. And so imagine you have a vehicle coming at you at 25 miles an hour, you are also traveling at 35 miles an hour, we've got a combined speed of 60, 70 miles an hour, and you limit the reaction time that's possible. So I think it's sort of an aspirational thing to say that, oh, the cyclist can adjust their driving. What you've really done is you've reduced the amount of reaction time that everyone has in that situation, and I think you'd be much more likely to come into conflict. I also think that this is sort of symptomatic of a lot of drivers, which is that they believe that it's up to the cyclist to avoid an accident. And when he says adjust, the cyclist can adjust their driving, what he really means is get farther over to the side of the road when it's equally incumbent upon the driver to hit their brakes and wait until a safe place to pass.
Well, speaking of a driver hitting their brakes, Jana emails us. She says, my daughter slowed down when approaching a cyclist from behind during her New Hampshire driver's test last year, and her tester told her she shouldn't have slowed down. yikes. I have always told her it's much better to be safe than sorry and avoid potentially hitting a person at all costs. So this gets back to what you said earlier, Sam. I just think we're confused.
Yes. And again, I mentioned that there is not a strong sort of cyclist education component in our driver's education curriculum. And that just goes to show, I mean, that driver's that tester, I suppose it is flat out wrong. I mean, the law says you pass with 3 feet of space around a cyclist. And if you cannot pass with 3 feet of space safely, you wait until you can.
So does all this confusion prove Forrester's point that because we've got some separate roads and some bike paths and we've started to build, you know, what he might call namby-pamby, the scaredy-cat infrastructure, which a lot of people like, is this confusion proving his point?
I think the confusion shows that there's not a silver bullet, right? You can't just implement, you can't just create some bike lanes and pow, the problem's gone. If you really want to get more people riding bikes, which presumably we do because climate change, because the obesity epidemic, because our problems with our traffic on our infrastructure, all of which are cycling is a solution to those. If you really want to get more people out on bikes, it's about a lot of things. It's about driver education, it's about cyclist education, and it's about cycling infrastructure. That said, vehicular cycling, John Forrester's school of thought, will keep you safe compared to other ways of riding a bike. So if you want to keep yourself as safe as possible on the infrastructure that we have, John's not wrong that you should be out farther into the middle of the lane, because what that does is it requires cars to slow down if they're going to pass you.
If they see you.
If they see you, which of course...
Getting back to our earlier theme of people not paying attention.
Texting, they might not. And you know, a lot of vehicular cyclist critics will point this out, that cyclists are not always seen. So yes, if they see you, they will have to hit their brakes, and because they won't be able to just squeeze around you because you haven't given them the space to do that. And so that's one of the fundamental recommendations that vehicular cycling gives, is ride farther out into the center of the lane so that cars can't get around you unsafely.
So in a way, he's right. But in a way, his ideas make people terrified.
Well, I'd say that John Forrester's philosophy will keep you as safe as is possible on the roads that we have
currently.
But his philosophy also led him to this conclusion, which then led him to fight against infrastructure that would have genuinely kept cyclists much safer.
Let's take another call, and then I want to ask you about that infrastructure question, because again, that's why this still affects us today, even though this conversation's been going on, as you told us, Sam, since the 70s. Let's go to Grantham. Rick is on the line. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for the show and
sure.
Great comments, John. I used to ride an awful lot, and I'll tell you that Forrester's book saved my life. I'm sure of that. You know, in faced with a situation where you're in a single lane, squeezing in the edge and having the car try and just drive past you is a way to get killed. Take the lane is the only thing to do. Second, that the biggest danger is that the car is going to speed past you and then turn right in front of you. He can slow down faster than you can. You'll crash into him. That little piece saved me as well.
Wow.
A comment on bike lanes and bike paths. I've had three, reasonably bad accidents. All three were on bike paths mixed with pedestrians. I favor the bike lanes because I think that gives a little more separation. I don't favor riding, at least not serious riding, on places where there are a bunch of pedestrians.
Well, Rick, thank you for calling. And so here's somebody, Sam, who says, look, John Forrester, his philosophy saved me.
And that's, I think this is a great moment to have that come in because of what we were just talking about, that on the infrastructure that we've got, John, I completely believe that vehicular cycling is the way to keep yourself as safe as possible. Where I disagree with John Forrester is his advocacy against separated infrastructure. Now, there were a couple really interesting moments from the call that we just had. One of the things he said is serious riding. For serious riding, he doesn't like mixed infrastructure. And what he means is fast riding, because if you're on a recreational bike path that is also shared with rollerbladers and people with dogs with leashes, it is true you can't ride, you can't average 20 miles an hour on one of those paths. You will also have to hit your brakes a lot. However, if you're a kid riding to the swimming hole, you're not riding 25 miles an hour. These paths are not designed for the quote-unquote serious riding that our caller just did, that our caller does.
So speaking of share the road,
You have to share with
rollerbladers and little kids.
And if you want to ride 20 miles an hour or 25 miles an hour, you can't ride on those paths. And that, I think, gets to one of the fundamental reasons that the sort of, as I said, the less than 1% of the population, the strong and confident riders push back against bike lanes, is that many bike lanes are not designed for the speeds that they are capable of maintaining. They're designed for the speeds that most people bike at, between 12 and 15 miles an hour. And when people like that who have enjoyed riding in the road and enjoy going fast are told that they have to slow down, they push back.
Well, so Rick mentioned that in his call, that he's had three accidents on one of those bike paths. In your episode, Sam, you interviewed Anne Lusk, and she was the force behind Stowe, Vermont's recreational bike trail, which a lot of listeners might have been on. I've been on it myself as a rollerblader and biker. And she describes her experience at a conference on bike infrastructure, where she presented some slides, she presented her project, she showed adorable children riding their bikes on this path. But she presented to a room full of people who did not share her views on separate bike trails, the John Foresters of the world. So let's hear Anne Lusk.
And I realized that I was being heckled, that I was being booed. The heckling was mean. And it was, you don't know what you're talking about. We know better than you do. And you can understand, it put me in such an awkward position because I hadn't anticipated that much difficulty in the room. And I thought I was going to cry.
Again, that's Anne Lusk speaking on a recent episode of NHPR's Outside In about cars and bikes sharing the road. So, Sam, when did the Anne Lusks of the world start saying, okay, not everybody is this sort of aggressive, let's say it, male, most of them are men, cyclists out in front, you know, sharing the road with the cars, right in front, acting like a vehicle. When did the Anne Lusks of the world start saying, look, this isn't working for everyone? Maybe it's working for you, John. It's not working for everybody else.
I'd say that the pushback from the Anne Lusks of the world, if we're going to classify them that way, began with watching the success of the Scandinavian countries and you know, sort of Northern European countries that began to invest in cycling infrastructure. And what happened, as I mentioned before, is a dramatic rise in the number of people who are using bicycles as transportation once they had the infrastructure. Sort of like, if you build it, they will come.
So transportation, they're not necessarily out there to, you know, sweat and go 30 miles
an hour. They're not the mammal, as, you know, as I will soon be classified as the middle-aged man in Lycra, right? So
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. So, suppose I'm a YAML,
yes.
A young adult man in Lycra, right? Yes, so we're talking about cycling as transportation, people riding in their business suit to get to work. And now if you look at these countries that have invested in this, in these connected networks of cycling infrastructure, the mode share is absolutely incredible. In the Netherlands, it's 30% of all trips, 30% of all traffic is people riding bikes to get places, and in some cities as much as 50%.
So the Anne Lusks of the world start saying, look, this is working elsewhere. How hard is it for them to get everybody else to come along?
It has been incredibly hard. So we mentioned the AASHTO guidelines and the prohibition against building protected bike lanes that were in those guidelines. That prohibition wasn't changed until 2012. So just a few years ago that it was finally reversed that, oh, actually, maybe cyclists need their own separate infrastructure. Maybe they do, in fact, need, at least in some places, to be pulled out of the stream of traffic. And you know, a lot of people, I think a lot of vehicular cyclists would say, what are we going to do? Are we going to build these everywhere? And I think the answer to that is no. You start with the roads that are most dangerous for cyclists and then sort of work your way out from there as the populace demands it.
So we're seeing a shift more and more towards the other view, biking for commuting, biking for kids, grandmas, whoever.
Yeah, well, designing bike paths so that you know, that 60% of people who are interested but concerned would feel safe getting on a bike.
All right. Well, Sam, we could have talked about this for the whole hour, but we're going to switch gears. But I promise everybody who's on the line, we will definitely look at this topic again later because there's huge interest among our listeners. But we're going to switch gears after the break and look at another summer-themed show that Outside In brought us recently, lobster, and whether American lobsters are considered an invasive species in Northern Europe. Wow, really interesting. We'll follow up on that after a short break and take your calls on that topic. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, gun-related red flag laws, what they are, and why so few states have them. We'll find out more tomorrow. This hour, we're kicking off summer by picking up on some recent summer-themed episodes of NHPR's Outside In with Sam Evans Brown. We've been talking about bikes and cars sharing the road. We're going to switch gears now, though, and talk about lobster and why Scandinavians worry New England lobster could be an invasive species. Give us your questions and comments on that. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Sam Evans Brown is still with me in studio, again, host of NHPR's Outside In. That's our show about the natural world and how we use it. To check out any of the episodes of Outside In, go to nhpr.org or subscribe to the Outside In podcast. Also joining us for this segment is Bob Stenick. He's a lobster researcher at the University of Maine. And Bob, a big welcome. Thanks for being on The Exchange.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, so Sam, this story starts almost 20 years ago with a rogue lobster, cue the dramatic music, found in Scandinavian waters. So who or what was this rogue lobster?
So the first American lobster found in Scandinavian waters was found by a fisherman in Norway, and he brought it in to a researcher with the Norwegian Institute for Marine Research, Anne Lisbeth Agnalt. And he basically said, this is a weird looking lobster because European and American lobsters look fairly similar. The main difference is their coloration. And they did genetic testing on it, and they discovered that, yes, in fact, this is an American lobster that had been caught from the wild in Scandinavian waters. And then, you know, for a couple of years after that, there'd be the odd American lobster found here or there. And then in 2010, they found a female American lobster that had a clutch of fertilized hybrid lobster eggs. And that's when the story got very serious.
Well, and of course, the big question that came to my mind and probably a lot of listeners' minds when this researcher, Anne Lisbeth Agnalt, describes this lobster that was found in 1999. And people said, well, how did it get there? You know, it can't crawl across the Atlantic Ocean, Sam, right? That's a long trip, and I think it's too deep for a lobster.
I think mostly it's the distance.
But, yeah.
but you know, how they get there is that we are exporting live lobsters to Europe all the time. It's a very profitable market. I've been told it's $150 million a year for the American lobster industry. And once they get there, though, the question of how they're getting out is a little fuzzier. It's unlikely but possible that they're actually escaping from the import facilities themselves. Sometimes people will, I was told by Scandinavian researchers, that they will buy a live lobster, and then to keep it fresh, they'll just put it in a lobster pot and hang it out the end of their dock, so they could be escaping from those.
Oops, yep. Sure.
but also there have been these high-profile instances of Buddhists or animal rights activists buying hundreds of lobsters and releasing them en masse for good karma or to save them from the pot, and who are often very swiftly fined after it's been discovered that they have done this.
Well, let's hear one of these researchers. Again, this is Anne Lisbeth Agnalt talking about some of the theories about how American lobsters could be showing up in Norway or Sweden.
Stupid people, whether they release them on purpose or they release them by chance, they think they are dead and then they are not. Or if they keep them in some kind of containers in the ocean and then there is a hole in this container and then they escape. I mean, there are a whole bunch of scenarios.
Whole bunch of scenarios about how these lobsters could be showing up in Scandinavia. And Bob, to you, first of all, just remind us, and this is why this story is so important, how big a deal is Europe for New England lobstermen and women?
It is an important market. We harvest many more lobsters than they do in Europe. If you take all the European lobsters that are caught from Iceland to the Mediterranean, that total is less than what is caught in Penobscot Bay, Maine.
Wow. So we just have more than they do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's, you know, when you plot them on the same graph, you can't even see the European lobster off of the zero axis. But they are dearly loved, especially during holiday seasons. It's a very important commodity around Christmas time for French folks. The big distribution is actually going via Canada, even though lobsters caught in New Hampshire and in Maine are shipped up to Canada for distribution. And one One thing that I heard, can't confirm this, but that at least one of the lobsters that was caught in European waters had a band on it that said product of Canada.
So it's a big deal. And from what you say and others say in Sam's story, Europeans love these, the taste, the way they look and so forth. Somebody quoted in the episode says every flight across the Atlantic leaving from Logan is probably packed with lobster. What's your take, Bob, on this whole invasive species argument from the Europeans, though? Let's dig into that.
Well, I totally agree with what we just heard, that they're all escapes. And there have been some holding facilities. I know the EU has become very, very conscientious about non-native species on land and in the ocean now, and with good reason. And so they're worried about, you know, if you hold a lot of lobsters in the ocean and they get out, that's a problem. It is illegal to hold them that way, but of course this happens anyway. The point that there are non-native lobsters in European waters is not at all a point of contention, but the question is whether they're invasive. And the definition of being invasive means that the population has to be at least self-sustaining, but usually it's a growing population. And at least in the United States, the definition requires that it does measurable harm.
And you're saying they haven't, American lobsters haven't done harm yet. And I'm, by the way, when I say American, I'm saying U.S. and Canada, but go ahead.
Right. And so American lobsters have been found in Denmark, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, and Sweden. And they're all of harvestable size or above. And there's not been a juvenile found. And there hasn't been a larva successfully reared from those hybrids.
So that's actually kind of the answer to my next question, Bob, but I'll ask you anyway. You said they're all escapes. How do we know they are all escapes?
Well, you don't know for sure, but it takes 7 to 10 years to reach marketable size. And yet all that time, of course, they're going into traps. So the fact that for all the lobsters that have been caught, that none of them are juvenile size, none of them are below a legal harvestable size. And then the other point that's really important is that starting at the turn of the last century, there were very big active programs to introduce lobsters in other places, Bodega Bay, California, in Japan. None of them succeeded. And there's been work done by Canadian researchers arguing that the temperature patterns, the warm and cold temperatures that are unique to the western North Atlantic where we are conducive for this lobster molt cycle and breeding, so that the warmer European temperatures, especially in the winter, are not conducive for reproduction in American lobsters.
Can you jump in on that too, Sam, the question of whether these are escapees or invasives?
Well, I think the other point that's important to point out for this argument that there has been no confirmed breeding of the lobster in the wild is that we have not seen any juvenile or adult hybrids, right? So if you were to find an American lobster that looked kind of youngish, you might think, oh, maybe two American lobsters found each other in Norway and mated, and this was the result. But you wouldn't know for sure. But if you found a juvenile or an adult hybrid lobster that was the result of a cross between a European lobster and an American, then you would know for sure that breeding is happening in the wild, and that has not been found yet. In fact, that initial lobster that was found in 2010, they've been rearing it, the babies in captivity, and of the tens of thousands that were initially born, only 65 are still alive today, and they're experimenting with them in captivity to see if they are in fact viable, if they're more like a new species that can breed, or if it's more like a mule, you know, you have a cross of two and you get a sterile offspring,
which you mentioned in your story. And I mean, that's terrifying. Nobody wants a sterile lobster, because then that
could also have negative impacts on the ecosystem.
Sure.
But they don't even know the answer to that yet, because the lobster takes so long to reach sexual maturity that these eggs that were hatched after the lobster was found in 2010 It's not, they haven't even reached the age in which we could discover if they could breed or not yet.
Well, one of the other Scandinavian researchers was quoted in your episode, Sams. This is Suzanne Erickson. She describes the research she wants to do to determine for sure whether American lobsters are making serious inroads into Europe. So she wants to test lobster larvae found far out of the ocean, see how many hybrids there are, check them out fully. Let's hear from Suzanne Erickson.
That's when you know that it's established, you know, because we already know that they survive and we know that they reproduce. But once you have recruitment and they start to add up in numbers, then you have establishment, which means that it's invasive. And it doesn't, you know, you have to remember that these are very long-lived animals.
So, Bob, two questions for you there from Suzanne Erickson. First of all, why is that important, that these are long-lived animals? What's the significance of that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, everybody has to realize that at least 99% of the larvae do not survive to become an adult. And so it would be very interesting to find larvae that show this hybrid. But I think it would be a needle in a haystack. But why it matters that they're long-lived? I suppose that if you're worried about genetic dilution, and a lobster has a very long breeding life, you know, some people would say that they may become sexually mature at about 10-plus years, but they can live to be 100 years old, granted.
Wow, I didn't know that.
That's a fraction of 1%. But let's just be conservative and say they may have a 50 to 60-year life. Then that potential genetic dilution could persist for a long, long time. It doesn't necessarily mean that if they're carrying a fraction of American lobster genes that it is necessarily a bad thing. But I do think that everybody would like to see, you know, the patterns that are naturally set by biogeography be maintained. And that certainly would be compromised if they had a breeding population. But they actually have to have a growing population to meet the definition. There's 5 points that they have to meet to be an invasive species. And this one doesn't meet virtually any of them yet.
Go ahead, Sam. Yeah, yet being the operative word. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the fact that they are so long-lived and take so long to reach sexual maturity means that if, you know, there were to be some sort of invasion from American lobsters, it would happen very slowly. And so we're making decisions on sort of our time scale for making decisions is out of whack with the life cycle of the animal. And so what we really need is a time machine so we can head forward in the future, figure out if they're invasive, and then come back and decide.
Yeah, well, right. Good luck with that. But so how does this lobster story, Sam, and Bob, I want to hear from you too, but Sam, you first, explain a bigger concept, the way Americans and Europeans view risk. It's very different.
Well, and this is what to me was the most interesting thing about the story is that if you followed European decision-making, especially on the GMO question, they leaned very heavily on something called the precautionary principle, which is to say that if we don't know what the outcome is going to be of a certain decision, the safest choice is to do nothing, right? And so in this instance, the safest choice is the status quo, to keep American lobsters out of Scandinavian or European waters, and versus Americans will tend to lean on the cost benefit model, which is to say, given everything we do know, what is the cost of making one decision versus the benefit, and the cost of making another decision versus the benefit? And I think that this is an instance in which even in the European context, the cost benefit model won out because you know, and it was kind of funny because the deliberation over whether to create a ban over American lobster was closed door, and that we don't have any record of who voted how, but all the countries got together and had delegates who voted on whether or not to give a ban. And
when was this, by the way? It was pretty recently, right? Last couple years?
I'm going to blow the date, but I believe it was last January.
Okay.
And the decision that they came to was that they believed that the American lobster was likely invasive, but that the economic cost of a ban would be too great. And so even in the European context,
wow,
this precautionary principle is a little fuzzy. I mean, it's not something that they stick to 100% of the time.
Well, and the researchers you talked to were, you know, kind of less than thrilled with this decision. But what do you think, Bob? What would have been the impact if this proposed ban would have gone through?
Well, I think that they are being selective on how they apply the precautionary approach, and I'm a big fan of that approach. But, you know, the fact is that there is no evidence that these populations have been able to maintain themselves, but there is a risk. But, you know, there is a risk of a non-native species arriving in Swedish waters with every ship that arrives. And absolutely, if you were to apply the exact same precautionary approach, then you would actually have to stop all shipping into Sweden and European waters.
Nobody, so how far do you want to take
do
it?
That. But you know, the point is that they're saying, well, even though there's no evidence, and there are publications that say that this population has not been established by Norwegian scientists, nevertheless, they're saying, on the off chance that this could be an invasive species, we should stop the import of lobsters. And I just think that that's being selective in how they're applying it.
Well, last question for you, Sam. So what are the Scandinavians doing from here? Europeans, but especially the Scandinavians. I mean, are they just saying, okay, no ban, we're done, or are they going to keep looking at this?
I don't think that they're going to sort of give up on this. Having spoken to Suzanne Eriksson, who's from Sweden, and Lisbeth Agnalt, their research continues. And I think the next thing that they're trying to see is they're trying to determine if breeding is happening in the wild. And so they're looking for hybrid lobsters in the wild at the juvenile stage, which, as Bob said, is a needle in a haystack. There's also, you know, if you're into science, there's a really interesting technique that they're going to employ called environmental DNA, which is where you just sample the environment for traces of the lobster's DNA. And if they can find eDNA of these juvenile hybrid lobsters, they think that that could work in terms of proving that there's a breeding population as well. But, you know, they certainly haven't given up in trying to prove that this reproduction is happening in the wild.
Well, sure, as we heard in that clip from Suzanne Eriksson. Well, both of you, thank you. Bob Stenick, it was good to have you on the air. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bob Stenick, lobster research at the University of Maine. Sam Evans-Brown, real interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. Now, if you want to check out these episodes that we talked about or all the other episodes, there's some really interesting material. Go to nhpr.org or subscribe to the Outside In podcast. You won't be sorry you did. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.